If you did remake this movie today, though, you would have to deal with personalities like the Paul brothers, right? I feel like if you did
YouTube personalities,
if you did like a 21st century The Player. I mean, I feel like sort of influencer culture is going to be part of it.
I think you just set it at some streaming agency or streaming company and just run the exact same script.
Run it through Netflix.
DMs instead of postcards, obviously.
Yeah, who sends postcards now?
He's getting gifts of him doing stuff. Yeah. That's the update.
I was thinking about that. That was sort of what I was thinking about.
It's that Caruso walking away from an explosion and just says you.
Yeah. Another thing I thought about this whole movie was, damn, I would watch Ghost by way of Manchurian Candidate. That's a picture I would pay a lot of money to go see multiple times.
Oh, it's so funny. Oh, gosh. Hello,
movies.
Everybody. Movies.
Arthur.
If not now.
Now more than ever.
Now more than ever. Hello, everybody, and welcome again to the Good Trash Honor Cast. We gather around a table. We discuss the films you'll never discuss. In the Film Studies course, we are on a new marathon looking at the movies about movies. Movies now more than ever.
Meta May, as Heath called it when I told him about it.
Oh, that's good.
Right? Yeah, I thought that was pretty nice.
That rolls.
I'm down with that.
I'll change that name. I'll take it.
Yeah. I am still Dustin.
I'm still Arthur.
I'm still Dalton. What was the first?
For the Love of the Movies.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
For Metame Works.
For the Love of the Movies.
But we do love the pictures here, and I'm excited for a marathon of pictures that love, hate the movies, I assume.
And if The Player has taught us anything, is that Hollywood execs don't love movies.
Or love them in a way that, you know, they love movies in a way that a therapist would tell movies, that's not real love, you need to get out of there.
Well, see the rap battle between Michael Bay and Alfred Hitchcock, it's all about the money.
Yeah, it is.
With slight edits. And so, yes, that's what we're doing here, and that's what we're seeing in Tim Robbins' character. In case you're tuning into the Good Trash Honor Cast for the very first time, this is an analysis show, not a review show. And that does mean we are going to spoil the ending, which I think is of some significance in this film. Not in, you know, of peak significance, but definitely significant.
What I'll say is I went into the film having watched the 15-minute little primer essay on the Criterion Channel, which does spoil the end of the film. But it's like a 15 minutes on like how Altman plays with genre.
Did it diminish your expectations at all?
No, not at all. Okay. By like an hour into the movie, I was like, well, this is a 5 because I know where it's
makes
going.
It more fun to watch.
Exactly. Knowing where it was going, yep. I was like, oh my God, that's where this movie's
going. Because I thought
about
rewatching it all week because I think that ending gives it so much rewatchability.
The letterbox that I looked at suggested that the rewatch did increase for the most part. Mm-hmm. Is what most of the letterbox reviewers I read said about it. But we are not going to do that to you, dear listener, and give you the choice rather than choosing for you. It is all about your freedom and not the authoritarian nature of the podcast.
That's right. In my left hand, I hold an empty film reel, and in my right hand, I hold a full film reel.
And
that's
right. And thus and therefore, we're going to, again, be kind to you, and this is how it's going to look and where the kindness, I suppose, ends and all spoilers. Bets are off. We'll begin with a synopsis, directly followed by thumbs up, thumbs down reviews, which we'll talk about kind of what it's about, but not what happens. And then we'll move on into a little game, which might involve thematic spoilers and gentle spoilers thereabouts. And then we play music, let you know we've gotten down to business. And that's when all spoiler bets are off. Arthur, I did see you looking at something. Are we going to do that something?
Maybe, but let's do this first.
Let's keep
it on the rails, bro.
Let's keep it on the rails. You
have a job to do.
I want
to
go off the rails.
Your job is to rein us in.
I feel like...
That's your one job.
I'm an agent of chaos, and I feel a little chaotic today. But we'll go ahead and begin with that synopsis if you have that for us, Arthur.
Where is it? After receiving several threatening postcards, studio exec Griffin Mill tracks down and confronts the suspected screenwriter... who may be sending him the package. A confrontation that ends in one man's death.
Yes, and hilarity ensues.
It does.
That's right.
In fact,
it's a comedy, but it's got heart in the right places.
And it's kind of a thriller, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like a thriller, you know, someone's going to have to die by the end. Oh, boy.
It knows what it's doing.
Let's
start here. Let's look at some one-star reviews of The Player from 1992.
I think that's a good place for us to start, since I know we're all new to this film.
This is going to balance this out.
Because we all like this, I think.
A lot.
And we're all new to it, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Because you hadn't seen it, right?
I have memories of it. I remember the bath scene, the mud bath scene. And so, but that's like the only thing I remember.
Tim Robbins' hog sticking with you?
Not really. It's just like, I've seen this.
Just flop it around.
I called it Hanging Dong, and Becca was like, psh, come on, barely.
Yeah, it's pretty light male nudity there.
All right, well, I'm not going to dox anybody, but here's a 1-star review from 5 months ago. All of these are from the within the last
are
few months.
Are these from Letterboxd?
This is just Google.
Just Google reviews.
It's funnier to read reviews off of Google.
Yeah. Just
because somebody went to Google and reviewed a movie.
Yeah, it's definitely funnier than a Letterboxd review. I agree.
I expect things like this on Letterboxd, but not on Google. I felt like I was watching an episode of Matlock. The acting, drama face emoji, was contrived. The storyline consistently made suspension of disbelief impossible. The style was like an early 90s. Yes. Uh-oh. The style was like the early 90s, still.
Correct.
Point stands. An absence of style posing as style. Where do all these stellar reviews come from? Just because of the plethora of celebrities who appeared in this monstrosity? The actors aren't bad. They're good. Which counters that first sentence. It's the movie, film emoji, that stinks. Vomit emoji.
An emoji laced.
That's fine. You can use emojis to review the film.
I think that's the way to communicate.
Fine. That's allowed.
There's only three of them.
Except for just being wrong.
I do think that.
I mean, that's
they
Matlock?
Say,
I don't know.
Matlock!
He does have a Matlock suit.
He does have kind of a, I mean, it's definitely a cream
colored.
There's
an early 90s look.
Sure.
I'm not going to argue with
that. Prevalent across media.
Yeah.
That's fair.
But this is also like doing a movie out of time look in a way that's kind of undeniable.
I thought the same thing. I thought it felt very 70s in some ways.
Production designer specifically, yeah. And the costume team, like 30s double-breasted suits is what they were going for. I forget what company paid handsomely to have their suits featured in the film.
Armani.
No, it wasn't Armani. It wasn't somebody I'd heard of.
Yeah, your money.
Yes.
Okay.
First time watching this movie, paced very slow. First 20 minutes with the same plot. Some guy sending threatening messages to Tim Robbins. This could have been accomplished in 2 minutes. I quit after 20 minutes. Could not take the slow pace. Tons of famous actors making cameo appearances. But extremely slow story development in the first 20 minutes. I don't think they liked the first 20 minutes.
I don't think they did either. I'm also on sentence fragment patrol here, but nonetheless.
Well, they're using ellipses, so I don't know.
Yeah, you don't like an elliptical edit?
I love an elliptical edit. However.
The pacing of this film is truly awful. We are introduced to what the movie is about within the first 5 minutes, and the story does not even move forward for another half hour. And during that half hour, literally nothing happens and none of the characters are that interesting or likable. I'd agree. None of them are. Well, the one, the script reader, Betty.
The script editor. Yeah.
Yeah, I like Betty.
Betty, is that her name?
Yeah, I like her.
I don't know. There's only three of those reviews, though. Probably because this is a good movie.
Yeah. No, there's very, very few probably 1-star reviews.
I am going to, real quick, just out of curiosity, going to go to 83 half-star reviews. On Letterboxd, 271 star reviews.
Star.
Wow. Hey, man. Not everything's everybody's cup of tea. And
less than
fair.
500 1-star or less reviews.
Yeah. So, I mean, that shows it's generally well liked.
1,300 2-star reviews.
Bonnie.
I knew it was close. We were close.
It was close.
What'd you call her? Betty?
Betty.
Yeah, I
name
agree.
Name out of time. Yeah. Right, Bonnie, Betty. Dustin, this is your first time watching The Player. What'd you think of it?
I really, 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 really liked it. It's so good. It's so fun. It's so funny. It is so smart. And I don't know what else to say. I mean, I think the way in which it is a love letter to the movies and a hate message of death and destruction to the industry at the same time. How to thread that needle seems to be a bit of a challenge, and Altman seems to do so very, very well. Dalton and I were talking a little bit beforehand, and I get this sense that I'm really sleeping on Robert Altman. I need to catch lots more Robert Altman, because I think he's got a vision, he's got a voice, and he's got a thing. Popeye is not a good demonstration of his skill.
I was surprised MASH and Nashville were blind spots for you. I assumed not either.
No. I've seen the TV series MASH.
Sure.
But he
served in Vietnam. He doesn't want to watch a movie about it.
Just love to steal valor for Dustin.
Oh, boy. All right. So anyway, nonetheless, yes, it's very good. I enjoy it very, very much. And love Bicycle Thief. So well done. Well done.
Wow.
Okay.
Somebody else.
I mean, to say this film doesn't have style is an absurd thing to say mm-hmm. when you open with an 8-minute fucking crane dolly shot combo that just like interlapping conversations. We advance time during this 8-minute shot. Mm-hmm. I mean, we open on the damn clapboard. just right there before the opening credits, we get fucking speed and marker, and then we have this mural that pays homage to Sunset Boulevard, and then we're off to the damn races. I don't know. I don't know. If you don't like movies, then yeah, you're probably not gonna like this. If you're not, you know, extremely movie mindset pilled, I don't know that this is going to appeal to you, but I don't know. It's still got a lot of fun stuff in it, even if you're not like a big cinephile. I think if you appreciate a good thriller, I think if you can get on board with an industry satire, I think if you like anything that treats one business as a metaphor for larger global issues, like, yeah, this movie's going to be right up your alley. This movie could have come out. We were joking about how would you remake this movie? And the reason I wanted to talk about that is because I think this could have come out 2 years ago
today. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this movie yeah. feels so you put out anytime. You could this could have come out in the '30s. It could have come out in the '70s.
It could be about Thalberg. It could be about Netflix. Yeah. Yeah.
It can truly be about any period in Hollywood history because Hollywood is a really useful metaphor for American history. And yeah, it rocks. This fucking cooks, man. And I don't want to give away the plot because obviously Dustin has already said we're going to be kind to you in that regard until we get towards later into the show. But following Tim Robbins on this journey from douchebag to villain to full proper villain is like such a fun journey. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny and Robbins plays it so well. And he is surrounded by an incredible who's who 90s cast, both in terms of supporting cast and cameos of people playing themselves. You know, if the cameos don't appeal to you, that's fine. And most of them are kind of nothing. I mean, yeah, the Belafontes are in here. Jack Lemmon's in here. Burt Reynolds is in here. Cher's in here. Malcolm McDowell, Andy McDowell, like, but a lot of them are just like
no relation.
Jeff Goldblum, but again, most of them are just there to be like, hey, isn't it funny we got all these people? Mm-hmm. I saw that somebody did the math and said that if it, you know, anyone got their asking price, their normal asking price, this would have been an over $100 million budget on salaries alone, which is very funny. Also, the most Oscar-winning cast in history, if you look at it in those ways. So some fun number crunching that has gone on around this movie. But again, if that kind of love of the movie's nonsense rubs you the wrong way, I think you'll still like this because it is about how all of these people hate the people they work for. Like, fundamentally, they think the people who greenlight movies are bad people who don't really like movies very much. Even Griffin, who is portrayed as a studio executive who like understands storytelling and understands movies, is not treated as somebody that like has respect in the industry. He has respect because he has made hits in the past. But when we open with this film, he is like on the outs at his studio because he can't close a deal. So like nobody respects this guy. Nobody likes him. And by the end of the movie, by doubling down on his worst instincts, he becomes more successful than he's ever been. And it's truly a story of what it takes to succeed in business without really trying. What a picture. I guess let's end on wrapping up the style question, because I think it really is this sort of, if you kind of watch some of the notes and, you know, features that exist on the production, it really was this kind of classic Altman planned improvisation thing of, you know, having, I believe, Michael Tolkien, the line he says is he gave Altman enough script to hang himself with, which mm-hmm. is where the film strip noose on the poster kind of comes from. And yeah, I mean, that is style. Like, letting the actors just kind of go with it, letting Buck Henry pitch The Graduate 2, a.k.a. Liz Lemon's dad, for those of you in the know, for the 30 Rock heads. That's boy. Just such a funny opening, and it only gets better from there. Like, even if you are only passively interested in the movies, I don't understand how the pitches in this like don't have you rolling on the floor laughing. They're such a funny feature of this film. And the fact that the movie like ends on a gag that it's basically been setting up the whole film is, whew, That's just money in the bank. It's funny. It's thrilling. It's suspenseful. It's got sex. It's got nudity. It's got it all. As they say, it's got heart in the right places. It's got a happy ending. What more do you want from the movies? Arthur, what about you? What did you think of The Player?
I really don't have much to add. It works. It's clever. It's smart. It's sharp. There's so much payoff to everything set up within the first 8 minutes of this movie. And so it's just clever. And yeah, I like what you said. I like that it's both a love letter to the movie, but a poison kind of snipe at the industry itself. And I think that's a very tricky line, like you said. So mm-hmm. I really like the way you looked at that and put that together. So yeah, man, I enjoy it. I like movies about movies anyway. Mm. And this is probably a top fiver, right?
I mean, this is my new favorite.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It's up there.
It's so good.
And it's just, it's clever on another level in its meta-ness in ways I wasn't anticipating. And so it's a lot of fun. And yeah, I mean, all the cameos work and Altman style. I agree. I think this is the movie that makes you want to seek out more Altman, you know, to kind of get a better feel, but not a lot of it's streaming right now.
Yeah.
I think
Long Goodbye.
Yeah. Long Goodbye is really the only one, not much of the main stuff, I would say,
yeah.
You know, your Nashville's and your Mashes and your Gosford Parks aren't really streaming right now. So, but yeah, great. Great movie.
Yeah.
I'm glad we watched it.
Well, there you go, dear listener. Our biases are generally pro regarding this film. I forgot the thing that I always say at this point. My brain
Nobody
just
knows.
Sort of, yeah, I don't even know.
I've been doing it 12 years.
I would say past pro. I mean, we are all kind of parked at 4.5 to 5.
Yeah, we love it. Love it. So we're going to move on to the next part of our show, which is called Expanding the Syllabus. And Arthur is going to explain to us what that is all about.
Expanding the Syllabus is the part of the show where we're going to cash in on the promise of the premise. And we are going to present to you this film as though it is in an academic setting. And we have built out a syllabus of adjacent and additional materials to supplement it and to draw out themes and connections and interesting tidbits about the movie.
That is right. Do you have a syllabus prepared, my friend?
I did. I've just got like a little thing here. But I like the idea of, so I don't know if it's a spoiler because it's in a lot of the synopsis, that there is a murder, which may be accidental, which may be not accidental, that takes place in the film, which is sort of a jumping off point for what is to follow, even though it kind of happens a little later in. But I think that is kind of in one of those reviews, the 30-minute mark is probably where that happens, I'd assume. And so I was just thinking about that trope of the sort of the accidental murder or the wrong murder or those sorts of tropes where it's kind of a madcap element introduced into a crime film a lot of times. Mm-hmm. And so I think noir plays with this a lot, but we'd be talking about that.
The murder that's maybe justified, but you know you'll never get away with it, that kind of thing maybe? Or well, let's see what you... Yeah,
it is like... Oh, crap, I killed a person.
Mm, okay.
And I didn't mean to.
Gotcha.
Kind of an idea.
I was sort of thinking
that typically is much more madcap.
Yeah, okay. I was thinking of Thelma and Louise for sort of that, like, that kind of harder edge, but I wasn't thinking of madcap. Okay, I'm excited by this.
I think there's something, I guess the place to start here is the Coen brothers, because I think they do it the best.
Sure.
And Blood Simple, I think, is a great example of this, where we maybe have a dead body. And then we do have a dead body because we have to get rid of the body that may or may not be dead. And I think it plays that really well. And that's kind of what I was, that kind of
gotcha.
Tone, I guess, is where I was going for. And so adjacent to that, of course, is Raimi's A Simple Plan.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think, again, we've talked about that at length in the show and in the way in which it's very kind of Coen-esque. But those two stories, I think, really are kind of what I'm talking about. This idea of, oh, no. I did the thing I wasn't supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
and now what do I do?
Mm-hmm.
From there, I want to go into a meta horror film, and I want to talk about Tucker and Dale versus Evil, where this is a big part of the thing, where it is just a comedy of errors where they keep getting put into really bad situations, which just furthers these stereotypes about them, and really does some fun stuff with the slasher genre, with the hillbilly horror genre, and has a lot of fun playing with that trope and the ways in which they try to work that in. To constantly put Tucker and Dale in a bad light, even though they're just trying to hang out.
They're just trying to chill.
Be buds.
Yeah.
And from there, I want to do, and this is sort of a kind of a maybe, Dalton, maybe more in line with what you're thinking, but I think Psycho. Because Marion's, spoiler alert for Psycho, Marion's murder.
From 1960, I think you're okay.
64 years ago. But Marion's murder is obviously not planned. It is not premeditated in a sense. It is feels somewhat impulsive on Bates's behalf. But it's also completely arbitrary. And, you know, the whole movie, when the genius thing about it is, right, the second half is like, where's Marion? Where's the money? She's been murdered for the money. She's ran off with the money. And none of that matters. Mm. Right. It is just the sort of nefarious evil that is seeping through America's veins at the time. Right. That Hitchcock's playing with. So I went there. I went with Arsenic and Old Lace. Play turned into a movie with Cary Grant about a guy finds a dead body, thinks somebody did the wrong thing, finds out his answer, maybe a couple of serial killers.
Yep.
And madcap hilarity ensues. And so, you know, that kind of tone, I think, lays in there. And to kind of bring it into the now, I want to end with a movie called Love Lies Bleeding from Rose Glass, where we get a couple of these instances in that film. Of people getting killed, some intentionally, some maybe not intentionally, some unexpectedly for the audience, to great effect, I think. And so that movie handles that sort of thing, I think, very cleverly and very well, and does a lot of things in a very fun light. But again, a lot of times it either leans real hard screwball, like Arsenic, Old Lace, or Tucker and Dale versus Evil, or maybe more into that noir, where that kind of, I've been pushed to this thing, but I didn't mean to do the thing. Mm-hmm. And now I've got to try to figure out how to deal with the thing. And so that's what we would look at. And that sort of the tropes and the things that kind of gravitate around that.
You know, kind of fits really nicely in the middle of those two categories of like this kind of movie. A film you mentioned on Josie and the Pussycats, Bodies, Bodies, Bodies. No spoilers for a recent film. Mm-hmm. But right. Doesn't it slot right in there? Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's a whole other thing, right?
Because of how
that plays out.
Yeah. I like that syllabus.
So Dalton, what kind of syllabus do you have prepared?
So first I was building something that was like an LA crimes class. But then I was like, wait, I don't even like, I had this whole two kind of bifurcated list, because on this one hand, I've got movies like Heat and Training Day and Double Indemnity and Boys in the Hood, movies that are in LA and are about crime. But on the other hand, I had this whole other list of movies that are about crime and media. And so I was like, this isn't an LA crime thing. This is a Hollywood murders thing. Mm-hmm. This is specifically about the intersection of Hollywood and crime. So some of the films that I kind of pulled together, I skewed more modern. I mean, obviously, there's Sunset Boulevard and plenty of sort of classic movies we could go to. But I did kind of deliberately assemble a more modern syllabus because of the player already sort of commenting on a history of crime in Hollywood in 1992. I kind of went for films that are either contemporary to the player or feel in the shadow of the player in some ways, or at least in the coaching tree of the player. So we've got LA Confidential, which is kind of, again, a throwback sort of period piece, neo-noir, that's kind of trying to go for more classic noir sensibilities, but with, you know, sort of late 80s, early 90s, you know, gunfights and squibs. And then, of course, in that mode, this isn't a Shane Black movie, LA Confidential, but then, of course, the Shane Black movies, The Nice Guys and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, are very much sort of Hollywood comedy noir films. The not super successful De Palma film, Black Dahlia, which was a big passion project for him, I think is still interesting. Again, another neo-noir period piece that's set in Hollywood. So, again, a lot of these films are sort of, again, along with the player, beholden to Hollywood history and sort of commenting on the history of this industry with modern eyes. But then I want to look towards these films that I think are very specifically about modern media. And I'm thinking of films like Nightcrawler, Mulholland Drive, and Southland Tales.
Yeah.
Southland Tales, with any luck, we'll be covering at some point this year with Chat Piles' Luther Manhole.
Oh, yeah. Sounds like fun.
Which Arthur and I have talked about, and I've talked to old Luther about, and he's very much looking forward to. He's actually already been asked to program movies with Southland Tales before. It's a film he loves quite a bit. So he's already got his list cooking. But I thought of Southland Tales this week because I think it really, I mean, just this like idea of a hot film that like is the center of some sort of larger conspiracy is such a fun element of Southland Tales. And then again, Nightcrawler is more about news media, but is still very LA and very much about sort of the media machine of Hollywood, even if we're talking about sort of, you know, news as entertainment, right? And then, of course, Mulholland is sort of about the intersection of film and TV as just sort of an inherently leering business, and sort of how they're existing in the modern space. obviously there's tons more films we could do, both rooted in the history of Hollywood and rooted in sort of modern media. But that's sort of the base list I came up with. Anything that comes to mind for you that you're like, ooh, that you should like want to throw in here?
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Sure. That definitely fits. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
That was just an initial thought there. Yeah.
Of course.
And like that crime being like the fundamental Hollywood crime. Right?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Absolutely.
I agree. Rick Dalton should have got that Oscar.
I'm still thinking about, I can't remember what syllabus I brought it up on a few weeks ago.
Not very long ago. Yeah.
It was when we did Lost Highway.
Oh, was it? Yeah.
Because we were talking about sort of Hollywood and violence against women in American movies and sort of the weird Gordian knot that is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as it pertains to the way L.A. and the Hollywood machine treat women. Like, I still don't know what I think about that movie.
I don't either.
I like it, I think. I like it more than Hateful Eight, I guess.
Yes.
But I'm still like...
That's easy, though.
Yeah, exactly. Not a hard bar to clear. How would you teach The Player, Dustin? What comes to mind for you?
I think I would teach it in sociology / philosophy, kind of ethics kind of questions.
Here we
and this
go.
Idea of the miscarriage of justice in media. I will simply say there is something of a miscarriage of justice that occurs in this film. I will say no more at this point, and then use some other films to also elucidate that particular point. One of those movies, I think, is Crimes and Misdemeanors from Woody Allen, in which one character murders his wife and gets away with it, and another character is kind of a bad guy but cannot get a break. And so what is that all about? And sort of as a question, it's got real big philosophical questions, existential questions in that particular film. Another film, Richard Gere's Primal Fear, with an Edward Norton, in which things happen in that movie. And I don't know if I can I spoil the other movies. Can I do that?
I think you're allowed to spoil the movies that aren't The Player, and especially Primal Fear. That's sort of like a famous twist movie that everybody saw on TNT.
Well, in the setup, you already tell us that we may spoil the movies in this section.
Okay. Maybe I'm all right. So
they've been warned.
Edward Norton is pretending to be a person he's not to get away. He's pretending to have something of a mental defect in order to get away with a murder.
He's not even talking about the movie. No. He's just talking about Ed Norton.
He's talking about Ed Norton. That's right. These guys are so sick.
and so I think it's a really kind of an interesting way in which that movie plays with the same kinds of themes in The Player. So those three really work together as a fun triple bill. The sort of one of these that's not like the other ones, but it also kind of is the Susan Sarandon starring picture of
with the
Dead Man Walking.
Yeah.
Which is almost in this movie as well. But nonetheless, it's perhaps one of the pitches, this Susan Sarandon film, and in which we see, again, a person who's executed, but it begins to interrogate the idea of the death penalty in general. Mm-hmm. And so Sister Pettie Jean, and it's great stuff. Great stuff.
Also directed by Tim Robbins.
Directed by Tim Robbins, starring Sean Penn as well. So, yeah, there's a number of sort of genetic connections.
What year did Dead Man Walking come out?
95.
That's what I thought it was later in the 90s.
It feels like
he had to hear that pitch for habeas corpus so many times, and he was like, damn, actually that would be kind of a good movie.
You know what we could do?
We should do a death penalty movie.
Yeah, and we just happen to have this biography, this amazing Catholic nun.
Yeah.
I just happen to have
this girlfriend who's a very talented and very famous actress.
So, yeah.
When the stars align.
Yep.
You're in Hollywood.
That's right. So, anyway, that's kind of the way I would think about this movie, is just the ideas in which that particular concept of justice sort of not served, and thinking about what that might look like.
Is it going to have to be... are we going to have to wait until after he dies for somebody to make a documentary titled The Crimes and Misdemeanors of Woody Allen?
I thought you were talking about Dustin for a second.
No. Somebody will have to kill all three of us to gain access to the vault where we keep all of Dustin's skeletons.
Yeah, and they are
deep vault.
Yeah, they are numerous. Nonetheless, yes, I think that would be fun, and I think your syllabus has got much longer, dear listener. But I believe now it's time we get down to business.
It's business time for business. It's business.
as Dalton said, the movie's style. You don't have that 8.5 minute long take where Fred Ward introduces us to the idea of the long take before giving us just a very impressive long take.
And then Fred Ward comes back to talk about long takes some more.
Ryan, remind us.
That we're talking about long takes.
Hey, you dipshits. No, we haven't cut yet.
You know, it's a weird kind of meta because it's not the fourth wall breaking kind of meta.
No.
Right. It's meta insofar as it knows what it's doing. It knows you're watching a movie.
It brings you in on the joke immediately.
Yes.
And then just lets you be. The other style thing, I think about this that kind of goes along there is Altman uses this almost phantom camera. Like, there's so many moments where it's just, I mean, the crane at the beginning is an instance of this.
But he does it a lot.
But I'm thinking of the scene where Robbins goes to the lunch and where we see Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
Because we have that conversation and we're party to that. And then we move through it to the Tim Robbins conversation with the producer he's meeting there.
Yeah,
I think, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
But there's this, like, I don't know if it's, I don't know, I don't want to call it omniscient, but there's almost this way in which the camera's not locked down.
I've got another one for you. When he takes June to Mexico and they're at the resort, we see the couple like nude swimming and then the camera leaves them and goes to June and Griffin. Like, there's a couple of times the camera.
So,
really
I think that's part of it. I think that's a way the movie just brings us into this, to be in on the joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. And it's a lot more easy to follow than, say, there's a certain obnoxiousness to Popeye and the Long Goodbye at times with the overlapping dialogue where you kind of just get lost into what's happening. And whatever happens with the camera visually also happens sonically. And so even though Burt Reynolds is just tables away, we lose that conversation for the sake of following Tim Robbins's conversation with the executive. And then as the camera comes back and Burt Reynolds comes back into view, we hear the tail end of some bit of that conversation again. And so it's easy to follow there, but it's also, it's omniscient, but it's focused. It's a limited omniscience almost. But yeah, I also very
it's
much
very
appreciate
playful.
That.
It works really well in the LACMA scenes where they're at the LA County Museum, which some fun story on how they made that happen. They basically made people pay for the pleasure of being extras in a Robert Altman film. Hmm. And then they bought LACMA 2 new projectors. So kind of a fun story.
It is fun
on the production here. But that sort of, it's so floaty. Mm-hmm. Right. And again, I think Arthur's right to kind of, or you're both are right to call it this sort of limited omniscience that it, again, we're privy to everything, but never at the same time. And only, you know, what's interesting and sometimes not even what's interesting. Sometimes just like what's kind of a fun button.
What's clever.
Yeah. What's a clever button on the scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
It does look like the floating camera in Mulholland Drive, actually, quite a bit. You know, you mentioned that movie earlier, and the director of photography also uses kind of a similar style, less cranes, but that very floaty kind of camera also appears in that film.
They had to repave that parking lot that they shot. Like, the whole area that they shot this movie studio in was, like, earthquake condemned. So they had to, like, renovate a lot of those buildings to use them. But they had to, like, pave the parking lot to even be able to do the dolly stuff to get, like, the smoothness they needed, which I thought was, like, oh, man, come on. That's just cool.
That is wild, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Some fun stuff. If you watch this on the Criterion Channel, which is one of the two places it's streaming, there's some fun special features if you really want to get into it, including you can just check out the Cannes press conference. They got that. It's great.
Yep.
It's good stuff. I can't believe I've been waiting my whole life to see Whoopi Goldberg as Homicide Police.
It's a fun bit.
It's such good casting.
Yeah.
And she's just like, She nails it. It's just sort of this kind of, again, she's very Columbo, just very this very unconventional detective.
Yeah.
But like immediately you're like, oh, she knows. She knows.
She knows, yeah.
From
yeah.
Just as soon in. As she shows up, she knows. She knows what happened. And it is just this like such an interesting push and pull of Griffin being nervous and then going from nervous to like gleeful. And again, he doesn't ever like get a scene where he gloats over Whoopi, but like he's gloating to everyone else. And it is sort of an interesting evolution.
Yeah.
I loved your observation about Lyle Lovett being a Southern fried David Lynch, by the way.
Yeah.
One of us, one of us.
People gobble.
That
one
little sequence
of us.
At the police station's really
with
fun.
With the tampon where they're all gag. Bantering. Yeah, it's yeah. so good.
And Robin's yeah. just like, why am I here?
He's just so nervous.
Life. Well, that's what he's afraid of, right? Is yeah. that he's going to lose his exec job. He's going to have to work a real job. Mm-hmm. And
At best.
Well,
at worst, he goes to prison.
Well, mm-hmm. and again, like the... He doesn't know the way the real world works. He thinks yeah. Whoopi yeah. has the big corner office. Like, it's such a funny, like, yeah. Where the hell is he going? Like, at the beginning. Such a good gag.
Yeah, it's good casting.
Yeah. She's just, as I mean, obviously she's hot off a ghost. It's funny. They name check Ghost in the first 8 minutes mm-hmm. of the movie. And then an hour later, Whoopi actually shows up, you know, hot off of her Oscar win.
It's such a funny, like, interplay between the fictional world of the film and the real world that we all know.
Like, mm-hmm. like who's an actor, who's really.
Yeah, yeah who's yeah, really yeah, who they fun. Are.
Altman talks in some of the interviews I saw about, like, very deliberately trying to, like, bring you in on the joke. And especially with the ending. On one of the interview sets, Robbins takes credit for coming up with him being pitched the ending. Because in the novel, I guess in Tolkien's novel, he like gets a letter and the guy's like moved to Seattle and like feels bad about it and like sends him some money for some petty vandalism he did to Griffin and is like, hey, my bad, dog. and it was Robbins that came. Obviously, it's not a very cinematic ending. So
right.
it was Robbins that came up with the idea. And Altman said, I'm never going to give you credit. And then says he eventually did give him credit.
That's so funny, though.
But yeah, like, it's such a cool button. And again, like, really ties together this whole, as you said, this, we're constantly in sort of the unreality of this movie that keeps lampshading its own unreality. And then, what do you call that story? A Song of Fire and Ice. Like, that kind of ending is so... It sucks. It's yeah. such a bad ending. And in this movie, it's such a dunk. It's
I don't
so
know.
Funny.
This movie lands the plane better than maybe any movie I've ever watched.
I mean, when he pulls up and you see June waving behind the American flag, just like fucking Altman shattering the backboard, dude. And even I was like, no, surely he doesn't mean it. I was like, this is just me because I'm me and I'm a little shithead about this kind of stuff in movies. No, Altman even says it in an interview from that the Criterion has from the 90s where he's like, yeah, you know, this is just about the crimes of Western civilization. I'm just like, fuck yeah, Altman, let's go.
Yeah.
He does know that that's what this movie's about. It's so like, it's such a funny ending to have this white picket fence American dream and then literally have children go.
And him have the last line Bruce Willis has, you know,
yeah.
I
yes.
mean, it's,
yeah.
Perfect. Just nails
it's,
it.
It's just perfect. It's just layers on layers on layers.
Yeah.
All right. Let's have this conversation. So this month is all about these meta movies.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Where are you with the meta film, the movie about movies? And what is our approach to what oftentimes is one of two messages? Either the industry sucks or movies are magic. Like.
Mm-hmm.
Those and sometimes they are tied together like this,
yeah.
right? But I'm thinking of a movie we're going to do later, which is all about the sort of degradation of 1920s Hollywood, mm-hmm. but then has this surreal moment where it's about the love of the cinema. I don't know.
Gee, I can't imagine what film Arthur's talking about.
Me neither.
The Hive will rise up, though.
I'm ready to contend and reckon with the Hive. Speaking of Chat Pile. Old Reagan Bush, big member of that Hive.
No.
Yeah. So I'm glad you bring that movie up because that's a like straight up coming out of the theater, 2.5 out of 5, but I like it mm-hmm. movie for me. You know what I mean? So I'm going into this marathon kind of apprehensive about movies about Hollywood as much as I love this film. What's another? I like Mulholland Drive a lot. Mm-hmm. It's probably like
my Sunset.
Yeah. Sunset Boulevard.
Sunset's yeah. great.
Singing in the Rain.
Yeah, yeah. Singing in the Rain.
Singing
I even liked The Artist. The Artist, you know, which is fun.
I love The Artist. I think yeah. The Artist is great.
No but, blind spot. No opinion here
but
for
it's,
me.
You know,
yeah, you missed that episode.
Yeah.
And we like Last Action Hero around here, you know.
Yeah,
we,
that movie rocks.
We enjoy that kind of stuff, and so I think the movies.
I'm suspect of it as a genre, though,
yeah.
right? You know what I mean. As like a
at awards is when I get more mm-hmm. more suspect. Well, congratulating I mean, ourselves for loving ourselves.
Like Empire of Light, Bardo. No interest in either of those movies.
Yeah,
and I'm like I know I should care. I'm just like. Huh. I already got to see Chazelle's Babylon. Like, I can't be watching this mm-hmm. other freaking, like, do it or don't do it. And so I'm interested, like, throughout this marathon, because I'm sure all of these movies will fit on this gradient of Hollywood makes art to Hollywood is a den of inequity.
Yeah.
And I think all of these films will fit somewhere on this spectrum. And so, and I think this one is sort of firmly on the Hollywood is a den of inequity side of things.
Yeah. And the movies are magic.
And yet it's magic. Yeah, yeah. It is sort of getting to have its cake and eat it too a little bit. Because it does rock that hard. Mm-hmm. And I think that's maybe why it's so easy to be suspect of this kind of movie, though, right? Because so many of them are trying to have their cake and eat it too. And I don't know, this movie especially, but probably most of, because all of them, I'm assuming this, Arthur, are all of the movies in this marathon about Hollywood specifically? Ooh, a big Cheshire grin appears across Mr. Gordon's face. So who's to say?
That way.
So if we, for today, think exclusively about Hollywood, it is hard not to be like, well, there's no better argument for a national film board than the Player, right? And obviously such an institution could be as corrupt as a Hollywood studio, sure, of course. But every English language speaking country, except for this shithole, has a national film office that, mm-hmm, like, helps greenlight indie movies.
I mean, every Western country for that matter. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just, you know, speaking of the Five Eyes, as it were. But yes, pretty much every country funds some filmmaking. And we simply don't do that here, mm-hmm, because we know we're the biggest dog in the yard and we don't have to do that. And it is bad for our movies that we don't do that. It's bad for the industry that we don't do that, but it's especially bad for the final product that we don't have a space for that. And I think Richard E. Grant sort of represents that idea in this film, right? When you don't have a national film office, you don't have an apparatus that says it doesn't matter if it doesn't make money. It doesn't matter if it pisses audiences off. It matters that we made a piece of art.
That's important. That's, yeah,
that we did something. We tried to do something real. And like Griffin pays lip service to this at the Movies Now More Than Ever party, mm-hmm, which again, somebody, I think it was Sam Scoville, who I used to do Sad Boys with, pointed out in a server I'm in that he was like, it's like McDonald's burgers now more than ever. Like, it's such, yeah, a crazy slogan. Like, yeah, it rocks. It's so good. But anyway, Griffin like tries to, and in talking about the performance, Robbins like speaks about how he really was trying to speak from the heart at that scene. So like Griffin as a character believes in the idea, or at least wants to be perceived as believing in the idea that movies, that Hollywood movies are art. And that's so rarely the fucking case. I mean, we have a whole podcast named after that so rarely being the case, mm-hmm, right? Thanks, Pauline. High fives to you. I'm fundamentally at war with myself over my affection for Hollywood, right? Like, I compared this very weekend before watching The Player, I compared myself to an NFL fan who knows CTE is real and thinks football needs to change, but fundamentally, right? That is where my appreciation and love for the movies is at. It is a institution,
love,
that I
hate relationship.
Yeah. How could you not? Anybody that's like sufficiently bought into movies is probably there with it a little bit, yeah, I think.
Well, and it's me with Marvel.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you know, I think about Thomas Schatz's thesis in The Genius of the System, this idea that the system itself is genius, is part of what we're trying to reckon with, mm-hmm, the, you know, removing the artist from the art. And part of, you know, he sort of moves against auteurism a bit in that book. And his discussion is that it's industrial, it's factory, it's assembly line filmmaking that, mm-hmm, the studio system produces. And yet sometimes it's also art.
Sometimes
it's also this other magic thing. And what trying to sort of wrap your mind around how it can be both of these things at the same time, this stupid industry with these guys of big cigars behind, you know, walnut desks. And then also,
look, every once in a while you get a 67 Mustang.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, that yeah, that's a good comparison, I think, actually.
Every once in a while you get 2001 A Space Odyssey.
And every once in a while you get a Geo Metro.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sometimes you get Doctor Strange, the Multiverse of Madness.
Well, yeah, you make lots and lots of Geo Metros, and every once in a while a lot of it's money. The 59 Les Paul.
Yeah.
I mean, would be, yeah, be sure, sort of comparison to it. And then which they stopped making in 1960 because, like, nobody cares about that thing.
I mean, this is sort of, you know, again, this is Altman's point about this is a movie about the crimes of Western civilization. This is a this is a conversation we're having about the American, you know, capitalist experiment. Like, does it create a better product as its proponents try to tell you it does? Come on. No, nobody believes that. The people who tell you that don't believe that shit. It takes a certain kind of delusion, even in Hollywood, to buy into the idea that it is always like good things are coming out of here. You can watch any given Oscar season and point to at least two turkeys in the bunch where you're like, they're trying to convince us that's a good movie.
Yeah.
Extremely loud and incredibly close.
Yeah. I'm not taking shots at Maestro because I haven't seen it, but I know a lot of people think that's a stinker.
Yeah.
So that's a fair example to bring up, I guess. You know, Joker for a couple of years ago, right? You know, whatever you want to
I still kind of like that movie.
A lot of people who are smart kind of like that movie. I've never seen it. Again,
and even more people who are smart hate it.
Yeah, I'm deliberately picking films I haven't. I'm deliberately picking films I have no dog in the fight.
I mean,
on.
Almost every year I'm like, no, these are not the best movies. These are the most movies.
So rarely.
Can't wait for Jokuary where we just watch Joker for 4 weeks.
Oh, man.
Christ. Oh, just different. Gotta watch Batman. We gotta watch Suicide Squad.
Just Joker.
Just Joker four times. No. Four different shows on the same movie. Can you imagine?
Let's see how it changes. Let's see.
Oh, my God.
There's an experiment in there we need to do.
Yeah. It's a marathon called Your Mileage May Vary.
Yeah.
Watch the same with movie. Feeling.
Yeah. There we go. Just four times. 4 weeks. The same picture.
You spoke to the timelessness of this film.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we all picked up on. Mm-hmm. It could be about Thalberg or Sarandos.
Netflix, yeah.
And yes, I think the biggest part of the movie that really hit that on the head was at the board meeting or the big executive meeting where Peter Gallagher's saying, just pass this newspaper around and let's get rid of the writers, mm-hmm. Which is so reminiscent of the 2023 writer strike and the conversation of AI, a conversation we had a few weeks ago on Roadhouse. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you could put this movie out unchanged.
Yeah.
And it's still extremely effective.
Yeah. I mean, Tolkien kind of talks about this in the sort of the modern retrospective on this movie about how, like, you know, nobody wrote spec scripts back then. We're kind of back in a spec script era. But back then, it was all about the pitch. It was all about getting $300,000 for fucking 25 words. And then, you know, trying to go out and write a hit off of some BS, basically. So it is interesting that we've kind of pivoted back there, but I'm sure the pitch is alive and well, and you know, plenty of deals are green light off of good pitches.
Sure.
You know, nobody's reading all the screenplays that get passed around Hollywood. That's just simply a fool's belief.
If I had known more about this movie and if I had had more time, I probably would have tried to get Jo Light in here because she used to be a reader.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Damn.
And that would have been fun,
cool.
I think.
That would have been cool. What was where did we start your question from? Sorry.
Oh, I was just the observation of Netflix AI, timeless.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I of course am always thinking about the, I always want to say it's Bob Balaban. It's not Bob Balaban. But anyway, the guy who plays Louis B. Mayer in Mank. They have him say the line about, the magic of the movie. The only magic of the movies is that the thing you sold is still owned by the man who sold it to you. Mm-hmm. That's what it is, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that is where, as you said, Dustin, like the assembly line of it, the manufactured thing of it, like it is all about, can we make a hit with this one at the end of the day? Even for a studio like A24, like, you think they don't want Civil War to make $100 million?
Oh, yeah.
There's a reason that's getting an IMAX release.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And obviously that movie's out and we know how well it's done by the time you're hearing this episode. But
well, even A24 has realized we've got to pivot.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to make quote-unquote blockbusters, right? They got this deal with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. You got Civil War coming out, getting huge press spots. I mean, media spots, I should say.
Yeah.
Because A24 has realized there's not money in niche independent filmmaking.
And they're still going to do stuff like Problemista, right?
Yes.
But even stuff like Love Lies Bleeding has to have like a commercial edge. It's got violence, it's got sex, mm-hmm. it's got nudity. You're going to see a famous person naked if you go see this movie, right? Yeah. That's sort of something they can sell a movie on. So it is interesting to hear that scuttlebutt around. You know, I don't know if there's actual quotes from were there ever sourced quotes about that pivot to bigger movies?
It's been so long since I remember that all started coming out.
Yes, but I know exactly what you're talking about because I remember reading that mm-hmm. same thing. That's interesting. That it does seem to be panning. I mean, again, like Iron Claw is a much more conventional film for them, even though it is still kind of artistically daring in its way.
But it was very commercially successful.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, was a movie they got people talking about. Now, how come this one's not at the Oscars? Which, you know, that's a conversation you want people having around your movie for sure.
I wonder about, you know, I sort of stumbled on it by accident, but I gave a guitar metaphor earlier.
Yeah, that was, I like that.
And, you know, because they're sort of mass design, mass produced, and again, sort of Leo Fender, so guitar lore for you all. Mm-hmm. Leo Fender, his great success was initially the Telecaster and then eventually the Stratocaster. And both of those guitars, they're obviously good rock and roll machines, but they were machines that could be produced in mass quantities relatively cheaply. That was the thing. And if you look at sort of guitars now, almost everybody makes some version of a Strat, some version of a Tele, right? Again, I'm very, very nerdy guitar stuff. But what really sort of gets the juices flowing for the artist is the one that has an interesting twist on it, that does something different, that takes this and then does something and sort of turns it over on its head a little bit. And these sort of boutique guitar players and guitars or boutique amps or boutique pedals, these are the things that the artist kind of looks for. But it's kind of unrecognizable to casual musical listener, right? Mm. And it seems to me like the indie studio model kind of does the exact same kind of thing, is that what they seek to do is something that is recognizably the same instrument, the same media that we're producing here. But there are enough of these quirks and differences here that it finds an audience, and eventually somebody famous gets attached to playing the movie or playing in the movie in this case, or playing the instrument. And then it begins to shave off all of those interesting bells and whistles, all those interesting rough edges and horns and differences in color palettes and whatnot. And it becomes very, very samey. And so part of what we're seeing going on in this movie is the way in which they're samified. It's Manchurian Candidate meets whatever it was.
Yeah,
Ghost now. Right. And yeah. So so we're just doing a quick little mashup here, but it's all these properties that we already know succeeds. Right. So I'll put some Telecaster pickups on my Stratocaster. Looky there, we've got the Nashville Deluxe Telecaster instead of, which is a fine guitar, I guess, but it's not really doing anything new, right? It's just a middle pickup.
It's Singing in the Rain meets The Big Sleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's Thelma and Louise meets Gun Crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is me trying to sell Love Lies Bleeding.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. And I mean, that is the fun of the pitches in this movie, is knowing, especially, I'll remove this context I have from after watching the movie. It's fun knowing that that is very likely a pitch that has been given. Mm-hmm. And then to find out after the fact, like, none of those pitches were written. Those were all real writers giving real pitches that they had ideas for, like, and like figuring out how they would pitch it. And again, we see in most of these pitches, and Tolkien talked about this in one of the interviews, like, by the end of the pitch, like, you're just pitching what they want to hear. Like, you'll turn on a dime anytime they say, yeah. So it's a psychic comedy thriller. Of course it is.
And I'm thinking kind of a Goldie Hawn. Oh, I love Goldie Hawn. Oh, yeah, Goldie Hawn for sure. You know, Goldie goes to Africa for sure.
Then again, like, to bring it back to the Richard E. Grant character, which, by the way, one of my favorite jokes in the movie is, get like a theater actor no one's ever heard of. Or like, that English guy that everybody likes, whoever his, literally as he's sitting next to Richard E. Grant in English. That guy, like, one of the Richard E. Grant in the 90s, right? Like, right after Hudson Hawk. Like, come on. But anyway, like, I love that character so quickly selling out by the end of the movie. And it is, again, because for your film career in Hollywood to be successful, you've got to have a hit, right? Like, a good example, right now they're covering McTiernan on Blank Check, right? Mm-hmm. And he had 13th Warrior coming out at the end of 99 and rushed to get the Thomas Crown Affair out before the 13th Warrior because he knew he had a turkey and he had to like pave over it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just crazy. So like that writer character that Richard E. Grant is playing, like, loses the belief in his artistic vision as soon as he sees a crowd react negatively to it. And he's like, well, shit, I guess we got to give it the Hollywood ending, because if this doesn't make money, I'm done writing movies.
Right.
And that is, again, like, I'm going to beat the drum for this probably throughout this marathon, but like, that is, again, like the value of a National Film Office as an entity that says
a risky movie. Yeah.
Yeah. It says, hey, this is just money we got lying around and it doesn't have to make a return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want it? You got a good idea. Or like, hey, I like that money you got. I have an idea. Do you think it's worth your money?
And that, again, this sort of independent production, again, music and film, very, very similar, is that when somebody does do something unique and individual, and there may not be quite the same promotional funding behind it, there may not be quite the same sort of star power behind it, and then suddenly it finds its way to eyeballs, then everybody does the imitation of it afterward, right? And so there's tons and tons of these same things happening again.
I mean, I hate to keep name checking these guys, but it's worth mentioning that, you know, this is happening for our friends in Chatpile, right? Like, they do a DIY record and now the second record like has professional mastering. Like, this is how it works in the business of media, right? Whatever the media is, we're not going to use the C word here, not that one, but like the business of making art is weird, fundamentally, and whatever revenue stream it is, whatever financing stream it is, like, there's weird shit going on in it. As you say, like, real art breaks through all the time. We're not going to spend this whole marathon saying, you know, we're going to talk a lot of shit on Hollywood, but obviously you've heard our top 100s before. If you've listened to the show, there's plenty of Hollywood,
lots of
Hollywood movies on all three of our top 100s. So it's, there's just no definitive.
And that rising tide sort of helps all boats. And so, when music, Nirvana comes out, you know, with Nevermind, you know, Pearl Jam's already doing some stuff, but all these other Seattle bands, they don't sound the same, but they're kind of the same, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Chatpile does great stuff. And so, you know, Chatpile is, increasing its presence as a band. And there's these other Orbital bands that they know them, or that they're friends with them, or they sound a little like them. And so
they're doing these shows with Nidosphere, who sound nothing like them.
Sure.
But like, they kind of got to be friendly with them, and they like the record, and like that, again, the rising tide lifting other boats.
Yeah. Right? And same thing with the movies. You know, this sort of chance gets taken on this kind of filmmaker, and then they say, you know what? Let's take a chance on another kind of filmmaker that's sort of kind of like what they're kind of doing, or at least, you know, out of the same film school that they are, out of the same class they are, you know, they're, you know, in
this very film,
yes,
Altman gets to do Shortcuts because the player makes money,
right?
He's trying to make Shortcuts when he gets the player off the ground, right? Like, and this is a guy who made MASH, a film that inspired the most successful sitcom of all time, Friends Wishes. Like, I've seen more MASH than I've seen Friends.
Right.
That show was inescapable all the way until the early 2000s. I know that
it's probably still on MeTV, right?
I'm sure it's on
this very moment.
Yeah.
I'm sure. I would be shocked.
ME stands for MASH every time.
Yeah. And I'm sure it's on Pluto and a bunch of the free streaming services have it. Yeah. So anyway, like, even Altman, and like, Altman will joke about how people would call this his comeback. And he's like, well, I don't know what you got. I've been here the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would give me money.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I've been here. I've been making TV. So it's so weird. It just goes to show how little this country cares about art. And I know that's probably another talking point we'll hit a lot throughout this marathon, but it is just frustrating that it is all about
dollar bills are going to be the best way in which to get your art out there. It's just always going to be the sort of baseline normalizing factor, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I've got two things. Yes. One is just an editorial note back to the A24 conversation.
Mm.
That all came out of an article from The Wrap from Humberto Gonzalez about A24 expand strategy from art house gyms to more commercial films. It is an article and an expose filled with unnamed sources from different studios. So who knows?
Gotcha. Right? Gotcha.
Could have been a hit piece. It could have been a leak strategy. Don't know. As best I can tell, this is kind of the exclusive article, but there doesn't seem to be anybody actually
nobody from A24 going on record being like, yeah, we're going to make some some more crowd-pleasing
films. It just kind of came out after the rumors of them looking for the Halloween rights and then the mm-hmm. thing with The Rock and et cetera. So who knows?
Coming off the success of Everything Everywhere.
I mean, yeah, the only way success looks is if you become MGM, right? Or Paramount or Columbia or, you know, whoever.
Yeah. You get bought by somebody, right? Mm-hmm. Again, like, we have Neon less critically and financially successful than A24, but obviously their name rings out in the industry too. Mm-hmm. And like, you have these two
better movies. I like a lot of stuff.
They probably got a pretty even track record, honestly.
I mean, there's plenty of
that Neon in your box, and there were some stinkers, and there's some good stuff.
Yeah,
but that's what I like. I mean, but I like stinkers, and I like good stuff.
Actually, I've been around you enough to know you don't.
Yeah.
obviously, A24 has more money, so they make more movies, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so that's a big part of the conversation. But sort of our two, you know, new Hollywood indie imprints that are sort of keeping American cinema vital. Like, the best thing that can happen to A24 is people talking about how Apple wants to buy them, mm-hmm. right? One of the best things that can happen to them is inking a streaming deal with Max. That's mm-hmm. right. Even I say Max now. God help me.
It flows off the tongue.
Just
wait for Paramount Plus or Disney Plus to just become Plus.
I ask for penance every night. I'm sorry I say Max now. I'm sorry, HBO.
All right. Well, let's end here.
Let's end here.
In the year 2024, you've already brought it up a few times. We're remaking this movie. Mm-hmm. Who are our up-and-coming A-list couple? Who is our Brad Pitt, Julia Roberts? I've got ideas.
I mean, or who is the Bruce Willis, Bruce Julia Willis Roberts?
And
Julia
at
Roberts.
The end of the
movie? Yeah. Yeah,
Bruce Willis. And
who's
Julia
the Bruce
Roberts.
Willis and Julia Roberts at the end of the movie within the movie? It's a Hollywood Chris. It's got to be a Chris.
It's got to be a Chris.
It has to be a Chris. Okay. And then the gal is...
Are they really up and coming at this point, though?
No, but Bruce Willis wasn't coming either. In 92.
Oh, okay.
Right.
That's an established action star,
true.
Though.
That's true.
So I think that's the thing you're going for.
And he's already... And then Julia Roberts is already done.
She's done Pretty Woman. But she is like... I mean, she's not capital J, capital R Julia Roberts quite yet. So I think, she's really at the beginning of it. Willis.
My eyes are rolling back in my head. My nose is bleeding. It's Chris Pine and Sydney Sweeney. And I collapse to the floor.
Yeah.
Something like that.
I accept that.
But who plays Tim Robbins? That's, to me, the more interesting question. Oof. Yeah. Who
Has
plays
he done
Griffin?
Hudsucker Proxy already?
In 92?
Yeah.
Yes. Because Hudsucker Proxy is 90 or 91.
There's not a lot of affable everymen that are 6'4".
Yeah. He is so tall.
God, he's so tall.
You know what I mean?
Tall king.
Freakishly tall.
Yeah, who's kind of an affable douchebag, but is kind of striking looking. I mean, I first thought of Josh Hutcherson because he's kind of fun in The Beekeeper, but he's a short king, right?
Tim Robbins mini-me.
Yeah, exactly. I think he's shorter than I am. Yeah. He's truly a short king.
Tim Robbins is such a specific thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
He's like a theater guy. Yeah, he's like a serious actor. You can't have somebody have an action guy, period.
Like, Cillian Murphy is like kind of there, but he's also Cillian Murphy.
But he's, he's almost better cast. Like, he's like Vincent D'Onofrio is definitely Vincent D'Onofrio. Like, he's almost better casting for the writer he kills, right? Yeah. He's too famous for that role now,
though. Yeah.
Man.
I don't know. We're going to think on this.
See, I was thinking Zendaya.
Sure.
Cindy Sweeney's the other name I thought of.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But either one of those.
That's
a good one. Yeah. Damn. Mm-hmm. I mean, Timmy's going to come up Tom Holland and Timmy are going to come about 100 times in the remake of The Player.
Yeah. They're,
we're going to be talking about them constantly.
It feels like the ones.
Yeah.
But I think going your route with the more of an established, so I mean, you could even throw in, I'm also thinking Ryan Reynolds because that feels like a very Ryan Reynolds thing.
Yes. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Wow.
The fact that we automatically just think that the Tim Robbins part has to be played by a man is just really indicative of Hollywood culture.
Gosh.
Damn, you got us.
Indicted.
Well, but again, I mean, don't you lose something if you...
No, it's an indictment of Hollywood. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, because you could make this like an evil girl boss movie easily.
Yeah.
But like,
with Blake Lively?
Yeah, I mean, that's
Hathaway.
Cool. That's,
but then it's kind of like...
That is kind of a good movie, though.
Wrong. I mean,
I don't know, that's kind of a good movie, though. But I don't know.
Yeah, it becomes problematic because if we make them villainous, then it's...
Well, no, I mean, I think that just speaks to the way that, like, sort of
Hollywood,
like, capitalism, patriarchy, like, all these evil systems, like, infect all of us. No one is safe, right? That's sort of what we get there. But interesting. I now do have to start thinking about gender swapping The Player. Mm-hmm.
I want to get wild with it.
Well,
I want Michael Stuhlbarg.
Yeah, dude. Okay, Stuhlbarg's got to be in the movie, though, right? Period.
Somewhere.
He's just got to be in the
movie.
He
could be a cameo, for all I care.
He could be the Whoopi part.
He could be the Whoopi part.
Stuhlbarg is like a weird homicide detective.
I want John Bernthal for Fred Ward.
Yeah, dude, that's perfect.
You need a good fixer who's...
Yes.
Yeah.
Bernthal for Ward.
Yeah, that's who I want.
That's perfect. Money. You got it, dude. You nailed in one on that. Who would you cast in your remake of Robert Altman's The Player? Is Robert Altman's The Player as good as we say it? Oh, we've skipped.
And Paul Thomas Anderson directs,
we got to do another thing first.
That's a whole other movie. I don't know, man.
Because he's such an Altman head.
Yeah, that's true. What do you think this... What do you think about this Kid DiCaprio PTA movie that's going to cost $100 million?
Oh, I don't know.
What do you think? You know, I mean, obviously we know nothing about it, but it is sort of like interesting.
I mean, on paper, those two together sounds like good, but...
But that's like the exact opposite of The Player, mm-hmm. right? Like, who's in a place in their career to make The Player?
Jeffrey Wright.
Dude. For... Robin's scared?
I'm
like
thinking
that.
American Fiction.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's fun.
That's actually very fun.
That's fun. I'm thinking, you know, who could make it? He's already unfortunately made his movie about Hollywood, but Fincher could kind of do it. Mm. Fincher's got that sort of right blend of like suspense and comedy, and like thinks about the internet, obviously, because of Social Network. So that's sort of... I'm just saying.
Yeah, that'd be a good time.
He's in director jail, right? He hasn't had a movie in theaters in 10 years.
It's crazy.
Tell me that's not director jail.
He blood signed the contract.
That's
Sarandos has his soul in a Netflix vault.
To me, that's being in director's jail. I'm having to work with those guys.
Either Netflix or Disney.
Yeah.
Like those are the two prisons.
Yeah.
Or Warner Brothers. They finally let David Yates out to make a movie and he did it for Netflix.
Yeah.
Wild.
It is weird.
Anyway.
Well, let's render us a verdict, shall we? I mean, which I'm shocking.
1, 2, 3.
1, 2, 3. Shelf. We're
going to go buy the criterion of this just for fun.
I mean,
because physical media.
Yeah.
Because the person who sold you the thing still owns the thing.
Yeah.
And that is the digital media model.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're trying to tell you in Mank. Buy your Blu-rays. Speaking of Blu-rays, if you want to get a Blu-ray from us, you can go to patreon.com/GTM. Find out a little bit more about getting something for you. And, you know, helping us keep this show alive. That's patreon.com/GTM if you want to pick a movie for us to discuss, like our friend Keithan from a few weeks ago. We got other patron picks coming up in the coming months, too. So I'll be looking forward to that. So again, if you want to pick a movie for us to talk about on this show, or if you want us to send you a copy of Robert Altman's The Player, is your favorite actor Tim Robbins? Is your favorite director Robert Altman? Pretty good chance we'll send you a copy of this. Patreon.com/GTM for more info on that. And now back to my little bit about what do you think about The Player. I was going to, prompt you to email us. But Arthur is right. We hadn't shelved or trashed this puppy yet. And you got to know whether or not we're shelving it or trashing it to know whether or not you need to tell us we're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So do you like this movie or do you think it's a farce? Do you think this is fool's gold? You can tell us. GoodTrashGenreCast@gmail.com for all that long form feedback, anything you got to get off your chest, suggestions for us as far as, hey, look, just because you don't give us money doesn't mean you can't suggest a movie for us to discuss or suggest a marathon if you got something percolating over there. We're not going to take your suggestion because you're not paying us. Let me rephrase it. We don't have to take your suggestion.
But a good idea is a good idea.
Precisely,
all the time.
Precisely. And hey, just the other week we were pitching a Parker Posey marathon on Josie and the Pussycats, and we got to help. You know, we would love help filling out that syllabus.
Yes.
So almost said Patreon again. GoodTrashGenreCast@gmail.com for that show specific feedback. Last but certainly not least, you can find shows on this network such as The Wheel of Randy with Dan Wade and The Praise Down with Heath and Alex if you want more good trash type stuff in your life. That's all I've got to plug. Arthur, this Meta May for the love of the movies is going to keep right along rolling for another 3 weeks. This is a 3 week, 4 week marathon, a 5 week marathon. Oh, that's right. I forgot there's a host pit.
Yes.
Anyway, what will we be doing for part two of this fine, fine trip into the belly of the beast?
Well, you asked if we were staying at Hollywood and the answer is no. We are moving outside of Hollywood, and next week we take this marathon international to another of the most influential cinemas in the world as we go to Japan and we watch One Cut of the Dead.
I knew it.
Ah, very good. Very fun.
Been looking forward to catching up with this zombie picture for quite some time.
I do love zombos. So, all right. Well, that sounds great. Well, you keep watching and we'll keep talking and we'll see you all next time. I'm not afraid.